The Guardian.
Well, if you speak of today's generation, if you talk of guys today, they know that, all right, a girl is well informed, a girl is educated enough. I mean, you can't control a girl. But then still, certain things are there, certain tasks are there, certain responsibilities are there, which are entitled to just women.
Her day starts by filling up her buckets of water. Then she prepares lunch or food for her children. After that, she comes to work, and then she finally goes back and do her household chores. She's doing everything on her own.
As a woman, my current organization definitely takes care of us, and we are privileged. I would not want to introduce my daughter to something called a gender issue. We all know gender means male and female. So the word issue shall never be linked for her.
You've just heard from three women with very different lives in Delhi, and their experiences resonate with many others across the world. We're living through a time of dramatic social change in the lives of women and what they hope to offer their daughters. The World Bank has just devoted its 2012 flagship World Development Report to the subject of gender equality. In this Global Development podcast, we're going to discuss why women are increasingly seen as the answer to many of the world's problems. And we'll also consider how the economic crash has affected women's lives in particular. I'm joined on the line in Washington by Jenny Klugman, Head of Gender and Development for the World Bank, and in the studio by Rachel Moussier from ActionAid and Jane Martinson, The Guardian's women's editor. Jenny, gender used to be a peripheral subject for activists and perhaps a few academics, and now it's taken centre stage. Why is that?
I think it's great that gender has now come to centre stage. There's a whole range of reasons why this has come about, but I think the most important ones are the recognition that there are enormous losses, not only for women and girls who are excluded, but also for everyone around the world if women don't participate equally, socially, economically, and politically.
And what are some of the major points that the report is trying to make?
Well, I think the report does a very good job in bringing us up to speed, both in terms of the enormous progress over time. There are more girls in school now than ever before. Huge progress on the health side. For example, the decline in fertility rates over the last three decades has meant that the number of children that women can expect to have is halved. This took a century for the US to achieve. It took only 10 years in Iran, for example. So enormous progress, a lot more women entering the workforce. I think an additional 500 million women have entered the workforce over the last couple of decades. So that's on the positive side. At the same time, there are enormous gaps. There are gaps in education, particularly for poor and excluded groups. There are still huge gaps on the wage front. Women are paid less for what they do. And there's also significant gaps in terms of voice, women's participation. So on each of these three fronts, social, economic and political, there's still a long way to go.
Rachel, you have some criticisms of some aspects of the World Bank's analysis.
I think this report puts gender back on the bank's agenda, which is good. But it fails to push our thinking forward on gender equality in a world where women are dealing with financial crises, rising food prices, and climate change. And the bank has missed an opportunity to look at these fundamental issues, repetitive economic crises, volatile commodity prices, and environmental degradation that call into question the current economic system and the implications that that has on gender equality.
Jane?
I understand where Rachel's coming from. I think the good thing about this is that where the World Bank has tried to deal with these overarching problems and talking about environmental degradation for a start, talking about the banking crisis, we haven't had action. I think actually trying to put gender inequality up there with smart economics is actually a good thing. Not because I completely accept ActionAid and lots of the opinion that says it's not just about economics, it's about morality, it's about social good. But I think that if we're going to get the World Bank, if we're going to get multilateral organisations to actually come and put some money on the table to try to actually get action, as well as the UN with UN Women, the only way, particularly because of the current financial crisis, that you're going to get them to engage is by saying this makes financial sense. And if we can try and do that, I think that's a good thing.
Jenny, I just want to pick up on the point you drew our attention to, which is the decline of fertility rate. One of the questions I would say to you is, has the bank taken this subject so seriously because it's actually women that can really help us tackle population growth?
I think that's part of the story, but I think it's not only from an instrumental point of view. I think it's an important part of women's empowerment to be able to have control over reproductive decisions. So it's not just kind of the instrumental means, if you like, with respect to concerns about growing populations, but I think there are kind of more fundamental human and moral concerns which lead to a focus on reproductive health, which allow women to make safe choices. But I just wanted to come back to one point, I think, which was made by ActionAid, and just to highlight one, I think, very important new finding, which is very much highlighted in this report, is this very strong message that growth is not enough. One of the traditional messages of a lot of World Bank analysis was that countries could grow out of poverty, countries could grow out of inequality, and so on. And what this report shows very strongly is that that is not the case with respect to gender inequality, that there are countries which have grown very fast or now have very high incomes, and gender inequality persists and remains a serious problem which requires concrete policy action. So I think that's, you know, that's a real departure for the bank, and I think it's something which should be recognised and hopefully welcomed.
Behind the slogan of gender equality is the complexity of millions of women trying to improve their lives. We're going to hear from three women living within a few miles of one another in South Delhi. Let's hear first from Sheila, who lives in Munerka village. We heard from her at the beginning of the podcast. She works long hours and is the sole breadwinner for her family. We asked what life's been like over the last few years.
She says that the past few years have been very tough. In Delhi, the prices have really hiked, and it's been difficult for her to take care of her 5 children and her husband. So in total, there are 7 people, and her income is somewhere between 2 to 4,000 rupees per month. A woman's life in particular has become tough because everything has become more expensive, be it cooking gas or anything to do with kitchen, the vegetables, everything has become more expensive. The prices are increasing day by day, but her salary does not, or her income does not increase that way. But then somehow they are trying to manage with whatever they have. She wants her children, all her children, to do really well in her life, and that is why she's working so hard. She wants to see her daughter as a teacher or a doctor. She said that she wants to educate her well. She wants her to be successful, because when Sheila was young, she had suffered a lot. She was married at a very young age. She delivered children, and that to too many of them, and it was very tough. Her life has been very tough, so she's working hard to make sure that her children, especially her daughter, does not go through all this.
This woman is trying to offer her daughter a better future by ensuring she has an education. The World Bank's report examines some of the factors contributing to gender equality. Jenny, can you explain?
Yes, I mean, I think that that's a great story, because I think it captures many of the constraints and the hardships, as well as the hopes of mothers today for their girls in the future, and the investments that families and mothers are prepared to make or try to make. What we do find in the report is enormous progress over time in terms of getting girls into school. And there are important policies associated with this. So, for example, abolishing fees are important. Separate toilets are important. So they're the sorts of activities as well that the bank has been supporting in recent years.
But there are other factors. What other factors contribute to gender equality? Is education by far the most important?
Well, education is clearly very important, but it's not enough. You know, it depends on one's overall measure. My own approach is to take a multidimensional approach. So I think education and knowledge is important. I think economic empowerment is important. So that's about equal pay. And it's about voice. It's about voice in the household. And again, education can play an important role, but there's no necessary correlation over time in how those come about. So I think it's an important element. It's an end in itself. Knowledge is important. It can have benefits for these other areas of gender equality, but they don't necessarily follow.
One issue Jenny picked up at the beginning of the programme, Rachel, was this issue that 500 million women have gone into waged work. That extension of sort of the market economy, is that going to really contribute to gender equality, or are there problems as well?
I think the report, as Jenny suggested, does do a good job at highlighting some of the nuances around women being more overrepresented, actually, in the informal sector, and that meaning work that's where labor regulations do not extend to, women do not have access to maternity leave, to social protection, social securities. And so you're finding more women in the informal sector than in the formal sector. And so I think, yes, there are caveats about women's labor force participation and the benefits that that's had. I think one thing that we need to consider is that women have always been contributing to the economy. They've been contributing through their work in the household, caring for people, taking care of the ill, the elderly, and the upcoming children as the upcoming labor force, right? So there's always been a participation of women. The second point is that low-quality jobs, very insecure, that keep women in poverty, are actually not something to cite as progress. I think also importantly, that the bank raises here is the issue around trade liberalization as one way of opening up the labor market for women. And I would actually say that the report is quite unconvincing on this point. They say that trade liberalization opens up the market and opens new jobs for women that are more, that has led to this increase in women's labor force participation. Actually, what we see, and a lot of research has shown, that women, that due to heightened competition with open trade, women are found in much more precarious jobs, even within the export market. So we need to think about, what do we mean by women's increased labor force participation? How has it truly helped and benefited women?
Jane, we've heard a lot about how the economic crisis has particularly affected women, both around the developing world and also in the UK. Picking up on Rachel's points there about, does waged work always represent progress? Perhaps you could...
I mean, I thought it was really interesting in the report and what Rachel was saying, that there are these fantastic concrete moves that can be made to increase girls' participation in education. I mean, even basic things like putting toilets, separate toilets in some places. Obviously, that in the developing world, that's something that the World Bank, and as a journalist, you're always crying out for action in these reports, you know, these huge reports that talk about lots of things that don't actually seem to do anything. But that's a very concrete thing in the developing world. And then obviously you get places like the UK where girls' participation in education actually outstrips boys. You know, not only do they do better, there's more of them in university. Lots more doctors who get educated. And then when it comes to all the senior jobs of being surgeons, they all go to men. So there's obviously, in terms of gender equality, this is a very complicated area. And the idea that what you need, as Jenny said, is not only to tackle the social issues of education, but also economic and political, in terms of political representation and change, is a really important one.
And Jane, the issue about waged work, is that a form of progress? Because what Rachel is saying is that actually sometimes it exposes women to more exploitation and insecurity. Mm. And indeed, there's been large amounts of kind of layoffs across different parts of Asia where girls have lost their jobs.
I thought, because you talked about the UK, I mean, obviously in the UK, the impact of the latest financial crisis has hit women harder, partly because so many work in the public sector in the UK, which is a different point to the one I think Rachel was making about this sort of waged work being in very vulnerable, risky areas traditionally where there aren't the labour laws. Obviously, they're two very different things, because in the UK, they are very much within the labour law because they're often working for government, and they've all been hit by all the changes that have come about by government action in the UK. So it's a very sort of a microcosm, if you like, and a very different thing. In terms of, in India particularly, in places where women are working in these jobs without any, women and children, in fact, working in jobs where there are the sort of labour laws don't help. This is something that needs to have political action again to stop it happening.
Let's hear from Deep Shika. She moved to the city from a small town called Kota to work in a call centre.
Living in Delhi is fun. Delhi is considered to be a very flamboyant city. Very. People like to flaunt here. And it's good at times. It's nice at times. Be it your clothes, be it the money you have, be it the lifestyle you're in. You can actually be vocal about your choices, about your freedom, about your certain opinion about different things, different situations with guys. I mean, you can be upfront. A girl in Delhi or in Kota is equally educated, I feel, when it comes to books. But then when it comes to implying those rights and those that information in real life, there's a lot of difference.
Jenny, a woman there in Delhi is describing her decision to move. And I wondered, in the report, you pick out urbanisation as a driver of improving and opening up women's opportunities. Can you explain a bit more about that?
I think this is a very important theme in the report and what we see from developments around the world. So I think it's in part to do with the importance of culture and social norms, particularly those which restrict women's choices traditionally. And I think for a number of kind of girls and women around the world, kind of physical relocation, moving is an important kind of way out to enable them to expand their choices. And we also see extremely powerfully from the evidence. I worked on Ethiopia for several years, and one of the striking kind of facts about Ethiopia is that in Addis, the fertility rate is below 2 compared to a national rate of, I think, still around 6.7.
One comment from our talk point, Richard Kavuma, said the biggest scandal is that you find those who have made it making powerful speeches in towns and city workshops, while in the villages, widows are chased out of their husbands' homes and teen orphans are traded for cows. So, Rachel, how do you reach out beyond the city to the countryside where most women still live?
Actually, I would say that the development sector as a whole has focused much more in rural areas than it has in urban areas. And that where urban areas provide a great opportunity to women, they also provide some interesting challenges that I would argue have not really been dealt with by the development sector as a whole. Much of our experience as ActionAid, but also as other NGOs such as Oxfam, Save the Children, has been in rural areas. We have worked in organizing women through collectives, farming associations, smallholder farmer groups. We've organized adult literacy circles to increase the skills that women have. We also run a girls' education program in rural areas to ensure that girls stay in primary school and continue on to secondary school so they can have access to better employment opportunities in the future.
Let's hear from Solby, who works for an international non-profit organisation with a strong equal opportunities policy.
In my organization, there is a quota system for women. Women candidates are given more preference for any job opportunity which comes in our organization, for any roles or responsibility for that matter. We also have flexible work timings. Also, we have a very good maternity leave system in place in our organization. It's a paid leave, one, and two, when you have your baby, you can travel with your baby wherever the organization wants you to travel. I would say I'm really happy and proud of that fact that in our organization, I see a lot of women as leaders, taking a lot of important decisions. Being a non-profit, we are working towards the betterment of the society, and it feels good to be part of such an organization where we are raising voice for a better society, a better place to live in, for that matter.
Another issue identified by the World Bank is the importance of women in politics. Does putting a woman in power make a difference, Jane?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, and you know, I'm a child of Thatcher, so I know that there are many issues around this statement. But having role models, I mean, anytime, so many surveys talk to girls, talk to women about who they are inspired by. And having a female role model, having somebody doing a job that you think, oh, maybe I could do that because she looks a bit like me, or it's a very sort of atavistic fundamental feature of human nature that it sort of seems to help. So yeah, having role models are incredibly important. The issue of quotas that she mentioned there as well, which goes with this idea of political representation, I think is really interesting. A number of very senior political leaders have talked about how they've changed their minds, female political leaders, not men, on this issue. Christine Lagarde, who's just been appointed as the head of the IMF, and Michelle Bachelet, the head of UN Women, both political leaders steeped in politics in their countries, France and Chile, who have said that actually they were against quotas because of all the issues of it's unfair, positive action. And now they think, you know what, things don't happen unless you have quotas.
Jenny, what's your view on quotas?
My own view is that I think that they're necessary, particularly from very low baselines. So where we have, for example, fewer than 20% of parliamentary seats around the world being held by women, I think quotas are clearly an important mechanism to accelerate change. You know, one could argue that change would gradually happen over time, but I think it's really far too slow.
Rachel, your view on quotas?
I think they're absolutely necessary. I would agree with both Jane.
We're unanimous.
Jane.
We all agree.
We do. I mean, if you look at, there are only 28 countries that have actually currently reached or exceeded the 30% critical mass mark, of which 23 have used quotas. So it seems like they are a necessary instrument. Mm. They are blunt, but they're necessary to get those targets, to get women in political office. Coming back to your earlier point about what we do in rural areas, I think often when we talk about women's political participation, we think about high-level political office. But there's also a huge gap in women's political participation in local government in rural areas. In many of these economies are rural-based countries. So, for instance, in Ghana, we've been supporting and training women to enter local politics and district assemblies. In Kenya, their new constitution has now set a quota system where 33% of all local-level representatives have to be women. So we're training these women to stand up for elections and participate in local government processes, which previously were always devoid of women.
Jenny, you've spent a lot of time working on this report. Looking 10 years ahead, what would you like to see it had changed?
Well, I should clarify that I'm not actually a director of the report. I have two very able colleagues at the World Bank, Sudhir Shetty and Anna Ravenga, who actually led the work. My responsibility now as director of the Gender and Development Group is to take this agenda forward for the World Bank. So clearly there's a major challenge. I think that the way in which the report has provided a good comprehensive framework is an excellent way of engaging at the country level to enrich the policy dialogue, so to raise awareness, to do further analysis which is needed.
Jenny, can you pick out anything, though? Because this is about frameworks and about data. It's quite abstract for people. Is there one thing that you'd like to see happening in 10 years' time?
I think an overall kind of closing of the gaps which have been persisting, a final closing of the education gap for poor girls, a closing of the pay gap, and a closing of these political gaps. So I think that these gaps provide an important measure of progress over time. I'm loath to say that one is necessarily more important than the others because they're all very much interlinked.
Right. Rachel, I just wondered, could you pick out one? Is it too difficult to pick one thing out?
It is difficult to pick one thing out, but for the purposes of this conversation, I'd say I would like there to be an honest conversation on national policymakers' table about women's unpaid care work. So all the work that women do, taking care of children, cooking, collecting water, the report has done a really good job at highlighting that this has an impact on women's access to education, to healthcare, to employment. And now it needs to become visible to policymakers. So I think that if we can start having a better conceptualization of women's total workloads and actually talking about that and integrating that into how we envision development and gender equality, then that would be tremendous progress over the next 10 years.
That's all for this week's Guardian Focus podcast. For more ongoing coverage of gender inequality and other development issues, visit guardian.co.uk/global development. My thanks to Jenny Klugman, Jane Martinson, Rachel Moussier. I'm Madeline Bunting, the researcher was Claire Provost, and the producer was Vivian Perry.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.